This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Today, the CEO of Toyota will testify in front of a congressional committee in the wake of several recalls, safety issues with some models, and allegations the company didn't act quickly enough. Toyota dealers will be rallying in Washington, asking Congress to be fair and pointing out the number of Toyota employees in the U.S. So how much of the hearings are about safety and how much will be about politics? Also, the bipartisan made-for-TV discussion on a healthcare overhaul is coming quickly. Some Republicans are calling it a trap. Will it be a productive exchange of ideas and compromise, or more of the same talking points from both sides? We'll talk about those issues today on Politics Wednesday here on Talk of Iowa. Stephen Schmidt from Iowa State University and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson will be our guest. We'll also take your phone calls and emails. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio, coming up after this check of news. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Today, Toyota is on the hot seat again in front of Congress, and also we're getting closer to the bipartisan made-for-TV discussion on healthcare reform. It's Politics Day, talking about those topics and taking your phone calls and emails. Our Stephen Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
And Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire political analyst, is on the line as well. Arnie, welcome to the show.
Good morning. We have to do this a little bit later. I'm staying up too late watching the Olympics.
Are you enjoying
them? Too
much
of a distraction. I can't handle it.
are you enjoying them?
Actually, I am. I don't even do a winter sport. I mean, the only winter sport I do is shovel. So I'm looking at this and I'm going, why am I so pumped? And I think in part it's because they bring the human aspect of these stories about how frail these individuals are, how their families are dysfunctional. I mean, all those things. And yet what you get to focus on is that despite all those reasons and those barriers to succeed, so many of them have been so incredibly successful.
That's a
moral for America. We have to get over adversity.
What I love about it is how excited the announcers get on their sport that they're doing. You know, you're watching somebody call the end of a biathlon, and I imagine that's right. What it must sound like for someone from Finland listening to someone call the World Series. They don't really understand what they're excitement. Well, anyway, let's get back to the topic at hand. Phone calls and emails, 866-780-9100 is our phone number, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Today, the CEO of Toyota will sit in front of Congress and answer questions about recalls and safety issues, and did the company act quickly enough? Stephen and Arnie, I'd like to start by asking both of you, how much of today's hearing will be about public safety and how much of it will be about politics?
It's about nationalism, I think, in this kind of an environment where, you know, the United States has been lagging behind the Asian tigers, and even though Japan has this economic crisis that, you know, lasted for 10 years and is still not over, and we still have been told the Japanese are so much smarter in terms of their business and management model and all the rest of it. And we saw the American industries lagging, and this is the first sort of big episode where, you know, one of our competitors has seriously misstepped. And I think the members of Congress, as this is pretty common knowledge, are all running for reelection and are going to take this opportunity to get some terrific sound bites that they can play when they're back in their district or post them on their website. So it is about safety, of course, because that's where this whole thing started. But ultimately, there's an undercurrent that is a zeitgeist that is related to where we are as a country. And I think it is going to be a pretty rude shock for the chairman of Toyota, who in Japan apparently is treated more or less like a god. And even when he's hauled into hearings, they bow and they treat him with huge respect. And our members of Congress are not used to doing that.
But I also think that there's the other story here is about the government's ability to do anything in the way of oversight. And we've seen this time and time again, because the story of Toyota is also the story of AIG and the big banks on Wall Street. And that is that everything is getting more and more sophisticated to the point where you can't explain it anymore, because on Wall Street they hired physicists and chemists and all these things to come up with products that even the bankers couldn't explain. And if you look at Toyota, you don't drive a car anymore. You're driving a computer. Okay?
Several computers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the problem becomes is that the government regulators of Wall Street didn't understand the products they were being asked to regulate, didn't have the support staff, weren't being paid enough, so they couldn't give anything in the way of oversight. Part of the problem now with Toyota is, again, an example of the government's inability to really be able to provide the oversight. I understand you want to starve the beast. I understand you don't like regulation. I understand you don't trust government. But when you set government up to fail, guess what, Jonathan? It does. It's amazing. It does.
Do you think that the public will see or examine a difference between Congress being very aggressive and really laying into a foreign car company compared to how they handled the domestic banking and industry, banking and insurance industries?
Oh, of course. You know what? They would rather go after Toyota than after Goldman Sachs. Come on. I mean, let's smell the coffee. Goldman Sachs is incredibly powerful. It buys and sells the Treasury Department. It buys and sells, you know, members of Congress. And it's able to get money because it's able to funnel it through things like AIG. So it's much easier to come down on Toyota. But the reality is that we need to have more members of Congress begin to connect the dots, Jonathan, because this is not a Toyota problem any more than it's a Goldman Sachs problem. There is something else here, but nobody has the spine to explain it to the American people that we will constantly be holding these hearings, and in the end, nothing will be accomplished.
But remember,
we will still,
Arnie,
be vulnerable.
When the chairman of the big three auto or the small two auto, as they are now referred to, companies, were hauled into Congress for their bailout. Do you remember they flew in on jets?
I know.
Their own private corporate jets. And you remember what the members of Congress did to them? Mm-hmm. I mean, they were not gentle on them. They beat them up so badly that when they came the next time, they drove little alcohol-driven, tiny little cars. I never could figure out, did they drive them all the way from Detroit?
No, they bought their cars in India.
Or did they drive the cars actually to the edge of Washington, D.C.? They flew into, you know, Reagan Airport, and then they got into the little cars to drive up to Congress. But they did not, you know, treat them with kid gloves. Many of them were fired, lost their jobs. And, you know, so there is an appreciation that Americans are very frustrated with, in general, the business community. And the latest Rasmussen poll that I showed to my class the other day was incredible, because large corporations and Congress are now at the bottom of the list of institutions that people trust in this very latest poll. And at the same time, in today's New York Times, which I have right here in front of me under my bottle of Pellegrino, right here, there is a column that says Wall Street 09 bonuses increase 17% to $20 billion, and that this is an astonishing surge and that it's gigantic. And, you know, people don't read the New York Times that much, but folks out there are finding out that when they, you know, get on an airplane, they're getting tiny little seats and they're not allowed to sit on the aisle unless they pay extra, and there are no more services and you have to pay for your bags. But the guys who run the airlines are flying in private jets and have three or four estates. And people, I think, are kind of angry about it.
Actually, so, I think if every CEO in America had to fly into Dulles and then rent an economy car and drive it into D.C., they'd have a different appreciation for a lot of things,
but,
I think.
That's why they don't do it.
Yeah.
But what's so interesting about all this is that even as we're saying this, and again, I think part of the reason why there is this passion to go after Toyota is that we have been feeling so bad about GM and Ford and Chrysler, because we used to be on top of the world when it came to the car industry, and we had our clocks cleaned by Honda and Mitsubishi and Toyota and Kia and everybody else. And so to some extent, the idea that they make mistakes too it's kind of important for the ego. Can I say this? And that's really what this is. This is about our egos. Now the question becomes, does that mean that, you know, two wrongs make a right? No.
Arnie,
what that now means is that how do we get beyond the wrong? Because what our goal is to create safety, security, reliability, and all those things. And that's why I go back to the regulators and the idea of starving the beast. You know, you can relish what you're doing to Toyota for a day and a half, But when someone gets hurt and you realize that we have no capable oversight, then you have to start asking yourself, what's the point?
Let's go to the phones. Marty from Garner is on the line. Marty, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. As always, it's wonderful to hear these two commentators. Here's my comment on this. I just heard before your show started that this guy from Toyota said, yeah, we know that we cut back on safety and quality. So he admitted it right there. And then yet I hear a Republican spokesperson saying, well, our government oversight missed the boat on this. And I'm going, now, wait a minute. You guys are always screaming about let the private sector go. And then yet when they do, you have no recourse. And then I want to add one other proviso. We just got a notice in the mail yesterday from Blue Cross and Blue Shield that my wife's monthly premium is going up 50%, and she has not had a claim in a year, in the last couple of years. So there's your unfettered private sector.
Well, you know, your comment is relevant in many ways and very interesting. I'm going to be going from this studio here at Iowa Public Radio down to the convention center to give the keynote speech for the Iowa Hospital Association annual meeting. And I was there earlier this morning talking to folks, and the rise in premiums coupled with the rise in the cost that hospitals themselves are incurring is really a frightening and out-of-control phenomenon. And as you know, in Iowa, 80,000 people have had their premiums with Wellmark increased. And Wellmark says, look, we are faced with such huge claims that we have to keep up with the inflation occurring in the healthcare system. And so there is this, it's a snowball effect. And it is therefore very important for us to realize this is not a Republican issue. It's not a Democratic, liberal, or conservative issue. It's just simply a systemic problem. And if Democrats and Republicans have different approaches, so be it. But both of them are going to have to come to some solutions with the private sector in order to make this all happen. And I think, we aren't sure where the solutions are.
No, but we know what the solutions are, Stefan. What is the definition of insurance, everyone? Insurance only works if old people and young people and sick people and healthy people are blended together in a pot, and therefore rates are able to be reasonable across the spectrum.
Right.
What has been happening, and I can't believe I'm going to defend Anthem, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, or whatever they are out in California with their 39% rate,
right.
But they made a stunning admission. And the stunning admission is that healthy people who used to buy insurance have decided they'd rather do the crapshoot. And the crapshoot means they're going to get rid of their insurance and pray they don't get sick or end up with a pre-existing condition. Okay?
We'll talk more about healthcare. We'll talk more about the Toyota hearings and the economy coming up after this break. Your phone calls and emails as well. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org or 866-780-9100. I'm Jonathan Aull. Talk of Iowa will continue in just a minute here on Iowa Public Radio. This is Iowa Public Radio's Talk of Iowa. I'm Jonathan Aull. It's Politics Day. Stefan Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are here. Today, Toyota is on the hot seat in front of Congress. What does today's hearings, how does that fit into the overall situation of the economy, Stefan and Arnie? Who wants to take that one?
Go ahead,
Arnie.
I'm so glad you brought it up. jobs. Okay, everybody. Because I started the show today, I'm such a nut, by talking about the fact that I've been spending too much time watching the Olympics, correct? Well, one of the things that I missed was that the CBO issued a report yesterday, and I think members of Congress may have missed it as well, and Scott Brown, my good friend from Massachusetts, you blew it, baby, because what the Congressional Budget Office announced was that the Recovery Act created up to 2.1 million jobs in the fourth quarter of 2009. May I repeat that? 2.1 million jobs in the fourth quarter of 2009. And as I'm saying that, you asked about Toyota. Toyota is not a Japanese company. Toyota is a Tennessee company. I don't know wherever else it has its plants and how many car dealers are selling it. There is no such thing as an American car maker.
Mm-hmm.
GM is making more cars and selling them like hotcakes in China. In China. They can't keep the production up. So we have to stop with the idea that somehow by bashing Toyota that you are somehow, you know, reinsuring that a job is created here, because you're losing potentially a lot of jobs if, as Toyota has done, has said we have to stop producing right now because we're regrouping.
Arnie, you're absolutely right. And the southern governors, of course, who don't like Detroit because the Japanese, German, and other manufacturers all are in their non-union labor states, you know, Tennessee and,
right.
and Arkansas
are
and so on, are freaking out. But, but Arnie, separate out politics and demagoguery from what you're talking about. And in the realm of politics and demagoguery and sending out vibrations to your voters, Toyota is a Japanese company. I mean, is the guy who's testifying a Japanese guy? Yeah, he is. So it's a Japanese company.
Toyota wanted to send the president of North America operations, that didn't go over very well.
Of course not.
It didn't go over well because they wanted to beat up the guy who represents the symbolic foreign auto company versus the American auto company. We're talking about playing two-level chess. One level is symbolic and the other level is reality.
Let's go to the phones.
This is truly Kabuki theater. Am I right?
Yeah, it is. Kabuki theater. Yeah.
This is truly Kabuki theater.
And even Kabuki theater is not even Japanese anymore.
Right. But we had to bring in the CEO, the family member of Toyota, because it's about theater and not solutions.
John,
I repeat, everyone, it is about theater and not solutions.
And the reason why
I brought up the CBO report is, damn it, we have to start putting numbers on the table. We have to bring a reality check here. You have to start looking at what is real and not what is Memorex. And the perfect example, and again, Jonathan, this conversation goes everywhere, but I want to remind everyone about the jobs bill. Do you know who the first person to vote in the U.S. Senate was on the jobs bill? Call in now. Who was the first person? Scott Brown.
Scott Brown, yeah.
In favor.
And our caller wanted to ask you something, Arnie, I think.
Actually, we have a new caller here.
Okay.
John from Ames is on the line. John, you have a comment about Toyota?
Well, the only thing I've never had one of these phone conversations, but this one's just wet my whistle.
Good.
You know, Toyota thinks that they've got a lot of money that they're looking at to spend. But just wait till the American public and the American lawyers figure out that they can go after these people.
Yeah.
You ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah.
And as she said, it ain't going to solve a thing.
Do you have a Toyota?
No, I don't.
Okay. I thought maybe if you had one and the brakes weren't working very well, you could retire even earlier.
Oh, stop.
Well, I've got $2 million sitting in a $200 million project in Costa Rica that the government's stealing from me right now. So believe me, I know what I'm talking about.
But
Americans have to understand that there are choices that we make, and I am thinking of India right now that has just come out with a car that costs under $2,000. That car would never even be allowed to be a bicycle in the United States. Okay? It would not be allowed to be a bicycle because it is probably unfit to drive, according to the standards we have set. And so, again, it is a cost-benefit analysis. So do you want a relatively 98% reliable car, or do you want to sue the company so the company is driven to its knees and then you don't have the jobs, the basically relatively reliable car, the ability of Toyota to improve on the problems that it faced right now? I mean,
Wait a minute, Arnie. Come on. You heard of Democrats such as you and liberals such as you are opposed to tort reform because when a hospital doctor or health care provider does something that damages someone, hurts them, they need to pay for it. And that's why
Democrats
do not want tort reform.
Actually,
you don't want the equivalent of tort reform, which is to punish an auto company that produces an unsafe at any speed product?
When I talk about consistency as a hobgoblin of little minds, but let me be consistent here.
That's actually never been a true statement. But.
Right. But the problem with that, what you just said is that as long as we do not have things like universal health care, that as long as we have to pay for our kids' college education, as long as Americans have to do something very different than you see in Europe, which is where tort reform, I mean, there is no tort law in England. But when did they get rid of tort law in England? When they embraced universal health care. Because it was a decision that was made, if we are going to compromise and say to doctors, you can on occasion make mistakes because we all do, then what they needed to do was ensure that everyone had access to a doctor and that the cost of medicine wouldn't cripple you because of a doctor's mistake.
Amen. So, wow, let's start talking about healthcare then. We seem
No.
I'm sorry. No, we're still talking about
are we
Toyota
still talking about Toyota?
Because Arnie decided to hijack my argument and run away from our caller who was talking about lawsuits and Toyota and so
no,
on.
No, I'm not. I'm
and
going
I'm
back
saying, you know,
directly.
We did that. You know, that's how Ralph Nader created his entire IPERG, you know, empire was by saying, you can't build a car that the gasoline tank explodes when people run into the back of it. And companies, when they get severely spanked by punitive lawsuits, sometimes, you know, correct themselves. And if somebody had sued Toyota for these brakes a long, long time ago and maybe done a class action lawsuit, we would have gotten this problem fixed years ago.
So, do we think that, Stefan and Arnie, do you believe that the American public will look at these hearings today and say, that's right, you go get them. America's got 26 medals in the Olympics, and Japan has 3. You go get them. Or will they say, now hold on a second, that doesn't seem to be the way that you're treating other industries. That doesn't seem to be the way that you treated the American car makers. What do you think the public impression will be of, as what Arnie described, theater, not solutions?
I can tell you exactly, because I've had people tell me, Toyotas, they're a really great car. I have a Toyota. I've never had a problem with it. These are a few brakes that are failing, and the media is making a big deal out of it. People are going to say, Toyotas are great cars. Everybody knows that. It's just they had some product problems, and Congress is now taking advantage of that, and the media is blowing it out of proportion, and the American auto industry is taking advantage of it by putting up huge banners at their car dealership saying, Toyota owners, come and we'll give you $1,000 extra discount if you buy one of our Fords. And, you know, I think the public is not nearly as invested in this as the politicians think, as the news media thinks.
I agree.
The problem
totally
isn't nearly
agree.
As big.
Totally
I mean,
agree.
You know, you build a car and at some point you're going to have some problems with it. As far as I know, very few people have been injured or killed with this. So I think it's going to go away pretty quickly.
And here's the difference, too, because we have now seen probably since the 70s that I had a bumper sticker on my little Honda that I bought in 1975 when I graduated from St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Yeah, sure, you betcha. And what my bumper sticker said was, Jonathan, this is what a liberal I am. It said, I would have rather bought American. Okay? That was 1975. Now, what Toyota has going for us, and Stefan is absolutely right, is that for years and for decades, Americans have lived, breathed, and slept the idea that the Japanese make a reliable car that sips gasoline, that can last in your garage for 5 to 10 to 15 years, and that the difference between a Japanese car and an American car was a quantum leap. And as a result, I think he's absolutely right. I think most people have had a very positive experience with their Toyota. And despite all the things they're hearing, since they've never met anyone where that happened to them, I think Toyota will survive this, but it's a great distraction when you don't want to deal with things like the public option or what's going on Wall Street.
Arnie, I can't believe you passed up the opportunity to purchase a 1975 AMC Pacer. That so would have been your car. More of your phone calls and emails, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, 866-780-9100. After the break, we'll be talking healthcare. We'll take calls from Mike in Mason City and Mary in Cedar Rapids. That's coming up on Talk of Iowa.
Oysters in the half shell. The way it's going, it'll be oysters with no shells. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Some scientists think we might be headed for a mass extinction event in the oceans. When carbon dioxide gets released into the atmosphere, a lot of that CO2 soaks into the oceans. That makes the water more acidic. When the pH gets too low, it dissolves the skeletons of animals like coral and mussels. Ann Dornfeld's looking into this. So what makes scientists worried about this?
They're worried about it because it's happened before. 55 million years ago, there was a mass extinction when the oceans became too acidic. I talked to Richard Feely. He's a chemical oceanographer for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and he told me that today's ocean acidification is happening far too quickly for a lot of species to adjust.
Over the last 200 years, we've seen a 30% increase in acidity of the oceans, and about 6% of that increase is in the last 15 years.
So some researchers at the University of Bristol in England ran a simulation of the acidification process that's happening today and the one that happened 55 million years ago before the mass extinction. And they've actually found that today's acidification is happening 10 times faster than the one in prehistoric times. And that could mean that if we don't slow our release of CO2 into the atmosphere, life in our oceans could crash within about 150 years.
So is the seafood industry or the people who bring us shellfish concerned about this?
It's really worrying for shellfish growers in particular. Along the Washington coast, mussel shells are getting really thin in some areas, and it's getting hard for oyster growers to reproduce their oyster stock, in part because the shells can't grow.
All right. Thanks, Ann.
You're welcome.
This is the Environment Report. The American dream of home ownership has translated into bigger and bigger houses. The square footage of a new detached house has crept upward for decades, even though families have been getting smaller. Sean Ali reports recent economic troubles have stopped the big house trend, at least temporarily.
Just after World War II, brand new single-family detached homes were about 1,100 square feet. By 2007, they were twice as big. One builder, Andrew Konovatov, says 2007 was the peak.
Money was available, and people bought more home than they needed. But now we've trended back the other way.
The U.S. Census Bureau says brand new homes shrank for 2 years straight, and home builders say they're going to build smaller for at least another year. That hasn't happened in decades, and builders like Konovatov are adjusting their floor plans.
In the smaller square footages, you won't see a dining room. You'll have an eat-in kitchen. So we've pushed out the formal dining room.
Konovatov says he's considering even smaller designs. He says it'll be trickier to make a good living, so he's not exactly happy with the trend. But there are people who are glad houses are getting smaller. One of them is Alex Wilson. He edits a magazine called Environmental Building News.
In building a house, we need lumber, we need new windows, and a whole range of building materials. And it's just common sense that a smaller house is going to use less materials. You know, even a so-called green material made from recycled content, there are still impacts associated with manufacturing that product and shipping it to the job site. When we can use less, we reduce environmental impact.
Wilson says he'd like to see homes get even smaller, but he doesn't think that'll happen until we truly fear a lifetime of high utility bills.
That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. It's Politics Day. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are here. I'm Jonathan Aull. We're going to talk about health care. The made-for-TV bipartisan event is coming up very soon. Very different opinions on it. Let's start with a phone call, though. Mike from Mason City has been holding on the line. And, Mike, you've got a point on health care you'd like to make.
Yeah, I would. I think what we need to look at, the biggest thing with health care, is we need to look at the cost of health care. It is a major problem, I think, of our health care system. You know, if people had to actually write a personal check each time they had a procedure done or went to the doctor, they'd be astounded of what it costs. A lot of people have no idea of what they're paying for and the costs. You know, when I went in a while back to get some blood work done, basically I was in there and they took a sample of blood. I was probably in there less than 5 minutes, 2 or 3 minutes, and they took a sample of my blood. I was out of there, and I know they have to do lab work on that. But, you know, when you get the bill and it's $400 and some, when I was in there less than 5 minutes, that's I mean, that's something that it needs to be looked at, I believe. So,
Mike,
do you
perceive that there's waste in the medical industry?
Oh.
I mean, where do you think the money is going that it shouldn't be?
I really couldn't tell you. I just know that that needs to be looked at as the cost of procedures in medical care. It's just people have no idea what they're paying. And like I say, if they had to you know, write a check each time for that, I think they'd be surprised on the cost.
You know, it's really interesting what you're saying, because we write the check, but we write it at a different point in time and not directly for this. So when you know, fill out your tax form and send in your taxes or have them taken out of your salary or your profits, whatever, you are paying for Medicare, you're paying for Medicaid, you're paying for veterans health care, you're paying for all of the, you know, local in the public school system, you're paying for the health care insurance and coverage that teachers get, because those are basically, you know, government programs. But you don't do it directly. So everybody is paying a lot for health care, but they don't realize what percentage of their income and property taxes are actually indirectly going to health care. And that's what a huge developed society with, you know, in which people don't pay for their own, but instead it's done, you know, through other mechanisms, ends up being. And you're right, you know, I mean, a lot of people would, A, not pay, and B, not be able to pay for their own insurance. I mean, rich people wouldn't care how many MRIs they get, because, you know, what the heck, you know, they're driving big cars and they're making a lot of income. And on the other hand, without public access to health care through Medicare, veterans, and so on, a lot of those people would have no health care. It wouldn't be a matter of them saying, well, you know, I don't want that procedure, but maybe I'll have this one, because many people's income is not sufficient to have most of the medical procedures actually done. So,
Mike, you must be living with me, because I just wrote a letter to the editor in the Concord Monitor yesterday, and it was entitled Bad Economics and Treason. And I want everyone to go to the ConcordMonitor.com and look at Letters to the Editor. That was the title from, I think, yesterday's paper. And one of the things that's the problem with your statement is that more and more people are going to see that bill, because the only people that pay that bill are the uninsured. You see, when you don't have insurance, you pay the $5,000 or the $700 or the $200 bill, because that's the billing amount. Then when you actually look at your bill, you'll find out something interesting, and I'm just going to point this out to you. It turns out that my husband just had cancer again, and here's the anesthesia bill. The amount charged was $3,534. Medicare approved, Medicare only pays $747. Blue Cross Blue Shield paid an additional $149. Now, that my husband has great insurance and Medicare, so therefore he doesn't have to pay the difference between the Medicare-approved and the Blue Cross Blue Shield paid. But if you don't have insurance, guess what bill you get? Do you get the Medicare amount? No. The Blue Cross Blue Shield amount? No. You get charged $3,534.
But how many people who get charged that $3,500 actually pay it?
And
that's where it just becomes this really confusing.
Right. Yep.
How do you say what something really costs when you're talking about uncollectibles, some things that are partially reimbursed, some that aren't? It certainly is confusing. Mike, thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Mary from Cedar Rapids, who's got another perspective. Mary, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Yeah, hi. So I got laid off at the University of Iowa last year and now work for a health insurance company who is nice enough to let me work from home once in a while, so I get to listen to your show.
Oh, great.
Because I can't sell my house in Cedar Rapids. So, you know, there's all this bashing of health insurance companies. Kind of I've seen it in a different light, because I've seen health care from a lot of different angles now, mm-hmm. research and hospital and now a health insurance. And, you know, sometimes the people getting bonuses are just ordinary people. They're not CEOs. And, you know, I don't think we should bash all bonuses, you know, when people are actually getting a bonus instead of a raise, right, those kinds of things. But, you know, maybe the model, yes, we do need more mandates of employers, right, because a lot of times they're having contract workers and things like that. They're getting away with not providing health insurance at all to those people, right? And, you know, some more regulated, you know, like maybe a more regulated industry, right, for health insurance, like we have with the utilities of MidAmerican Energy, Alliant Energy, those mm-hmm. kind of companies. It's a good model, right? It seems to work. You know, you're kind of eliminating the profit. You're doing a little bit to, you know, limit the profit on the, you know, so it's not excessive. But there are, you know, what I've seen is there are good things health insurance companies do. You know, my group negotiates with drug companies for lower prices. That's a good thing, you know. So
tell the government that. The government should be negotiating drug
prices. Yeah, they don't do it.
Drug companies. No, it's not that they don't. They were actually legislated and forbidden from doing it because under George Bush, when we passed the big pharmaceutical drug bill for Medicare, which is a huge consumer, that population is a huge consumer of drugs, one of the provisions of that bill that was signed in the middle of the night was that they could not negotiate with drug companies. They could not. And that tells you why what insurance companies can do is something that the government should do because it should be a level playing field. But they made sure that it wasn't a level playing field.
Mary, can I ask you a question? You heard Mike from Mason City a little bit earlier talking about the cost of health care, and I'm curious about your perspective working for a health insurance company.
The number of lab tests is just really astounding, I think. The number of lab tests somebody gets, right? Do you really need, lab tests every 15 minutes on the same thing? How much is that really changing, right? So, and of course, you've got a real problem with end-of-life stuff, right, that, uh-huh. The last, 2 months of somebody's life, right, is really very, very expensive, and, how much quality of life are you gaining?
Well, that totally makes sense when we're talking about it rationally, but when my 2-year-old has a cough, and if my doctor, just to cover their own, just to be sure, says, let's get an X-ray, get a chest X-ray, does my daughter need a chest X-ray? Probably not. But as a parent, I want everything. So how do we get people to accept that sometimes not having the test is an acceptable risk?
Yeah, and it's a problem. I had frozen shoulder once, and, my doctor kept turning me down on an MRI, and it's like, and he didn't do that. And it got better by itself. It really did, without the MRI. But it's very difficult, and if you don't have something like health insurance, who says no to you, right? Or that you should pay for, or co-pays where you're saying, look, you can have it, but you have to pay for a little bit of yourself, right?
Mary, thank you for the call. The question I want to pose to Stefan and Arnie, and Mary, thank you. That was really great. Stefan and Arnie, does the focus need to be on reforming the cost of health care, or does it need to be on reforming the cost of health insurance? Because I think those are separate issues.
It's got to be both because they're mutually driving each other. And the availability of technologies that are exceptionally modern and futuristic and very tempting to do MRIs and to do all kinds of other things is an invitation for people, as you said, about, if your kid's sick or if your kid is injured, you want every test done to make
everyone.
Sure that that they can be fixed. We are essentially living in the tyranny of technology and also drugs. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies, and I know a lot of people in the pharmaceutical industry. I have family members who are, chief, scientists for various pharmaceutical companies, and they tell me, we are the most regulated industry in the United States. If we start producing a new drug, it takes sometimes $1 billion to test it and to get the FDA to approve it and release it. We've invested years and years and years in it, and that product then is only good for the patent years, and then after the patent expires, we have to start over again or do something else. I have a tremendous amount of sympathy for the pharmaceutical industry and the industry that manufactures all of the devices. We've got parts replacement, knee replacements, and all kinds of hip replacement, and heart transplants, pacemakers and things that never existed before. We want those things. We would not want to live without them. We haven't figured out how to pay for them. Insurance would pay for them only if every single person were paying in a reasonable amount into the insurance pool. As Arnie said, we have so many different ways of covering all of this. The federal government itself already provides about 51% of health care, of the health care costs in this country through all kinds of government health programs, including Medicare, Medicaid,
water?
And so on.
I
can't answer your question because the two, go hand in hand.
Arnie, what's your take?
Here's my take. We'll start with the pharmaceutical companies and I'll work backwards. The fact is that the pharmaceutical industry is spending more on marketing than on research. Okay? So they're selling you the little blue pill, the little yellow pill, the little pink pill, the little this pill. They are not researching it. They are marketing it. The pharmaceutical companies are actually paying generic companies that sell generics, to not go out there and get and market their generics. They're actually paying them not to market it so they can continue to market their sort of interesting drug that has like maybe one little different color code on it so that they can continue to make their gazillions of dollars on this drug that probably could be replaced by a generic. So the fact of the matter is there's a lot of money in the pharmaceutical industry that has nothing to do with health and everything to do with an ad that you're watching during the Olympics, number one. Number two, on doctors, Stefan, the question you have to ask doctors and hospitals, and I want to put them under oath when they testify before me, do you own that X-ray company? Do you own that testing company? And are you double dipping? So therefore, one of the reasons why you want to overtest is that you make money on that overtest. You know, and right now in my state, a number of hospitals own all the doctor's offices in town. So when you go to visit your doctor, there is a double charge. There is the charge for the doctor and then the charge for the hospital that owns the building that the doctor is operating on. Now, is that health care? Did that make me healthier, or is that about cash?
Well, I don't want to put words in either of your mouths, so let me put something out there and get your reaction. What I'm hearing, and Stefan, you said both, but if you reform the cost of health care, health insurance takes care of itself for the most part, because if the costs were lower, you wouldn't have as many problems with insurance. Is my assertion incorrect?
Well, it could be, but let's remember that the real war that we're in the middle of here that is not going to be resolved with the meeting that's going to take place at the White House between Obama and the Republicans, and that is a serious structural war, is between the idea that health is a public good, that it is not like buying a luxury car, and the conflict with the fact that a lot of the healthcare industry in the United States is actually profit-driven, and even nonprofit healthcare providers have elaborate investments in real estate and pay enormous salaries to salespeople, to their CEOs, and so on. And so, you know, if you're a company that wants to make a profit, it is in fact your requirement, your mission, to make as much profit as you can, because that's what your stockholders expect, your board of directors expects. And in the case of healthcare, you then get the conflict from the other end, which is if that's how healthcare operates, then those who can't afford it, it's just like a Lexus. You know, I'd like to have a Lexus, but I really can't afford one. And a lot of people are not getting sufficient health care because the provision of it is so often really driven by the private sector. And I think I don't know how to resolve that conflict. We are a capitalist country, and a lot of the stuff we do here is, in fact, private sector-driven, including defense contracting. And we know the cost overruns in the defense contracting industry. Will we ever resolve this conflict between the idea of healthcare as a universal public good and the fact that most of the healthcare industry, including pharmaceuticals, manufacturers, and so on, are private sector for-profit companies? I don't know. I think we're going to be stuck in this struggle between those two principles for a very long time, until the system freezes up. And at that point, then we have to do something, and that's just – you know, the problem in a country like the United States is it's very difficult to bring into reconciliation those two basic ideas, public versus private.
And you can't condemn for-profit insurance companies because, by definition, the term is for-profit. They are doing what they were designed to do. They were not designed to make you healthy. They were designed to make a profit. And therefore, they will look at their pool of the insured, and they will pick and choose, or they'll cherry pick, or they'll do pre-existing conditions, or they'll say no to a test or no to a drug, because they are not about health. They are about the health of their profits. And that's legitimate. As long as Americans go in with their eyes wide open what the insurance industry is about, and if they want it that way, then amen. But if they think that health is something different than profit, the way I think, for example, you know, free speech is different than money, and again, I may be wrong, the Supreme Court has told me I am wrong, then we need to have an open and positive discussion about what we have and what we want, and do we choose to fix it.
And we are having that right here on Iowa Public Radio. Because, I mean, this is what we talk about a lot here.
Exactly.
And the thing is that it is not resonating all that much at this point, because it is very confusing to people out there, and they are also distracted by all kinds of other things, by, you know, the whole issue of gays in the military. Yes, no, should the generals, you know, they had a whole hour this morning on public radio with people saying, no, we shouldn't have gays serving openly in the military. Yes, we should have them serve. We are involved in so many discussions. Should we be in Afghanistan or not? Should we come home? How should we fight the war on terrorism? What should we do to stimulate the economy? So healthcare and health reform and insurance reform is essentially overwashed by all of these other discussions. Unemployment, you know, we have a big unemployment problem in this country, and people can't pick out the health part of that as being an important, crucial component of both the economy, jobs, and, you know, their own livelihood, because it is so confusing and complicated. So we do the best we can, I think, here from different perspectives, and our callers are fantastic. When we have somebody call, like somebody who's been in the health profession industry and so on, you know, you get some really wonderful new insights, and I think that's where we eventually may end up getting a consensus of some sort.
But Jonathan, what's so interesting to me is what I think happens is that we're also able to show people that there is a consistency in the problem, in that what we see as a problem with insurance turns out to be a problem with Wall Street, that what we see as a problem with Toyota. I mean, look at how it comes back to the same themes, but we never talk about those. Because, I mean, I was listening to someone who called, the person who called in to say, if you knew how much it costs to pay for X, maybe you'd be less reluctant. Can I tell you what that conversation reminds me of? Why did so many states embrace gambling? Because gambling has no relationship to the economy or whether we're bringing in tax revenues or not. So therefore, once again, we'll be paying for things with no connection to whether we can afford it or not, because after all, the gambler is paying for it. We're always looking for someone behind the tree to be responsible. And in the end, if you're going to be in a democracy, you have to be responsible.
You mentioned great callers, Stefan. Let's go to Jean in Anamosa, who's on the line, who has a comment. Jean, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Thank you very much. I love your show, and often wish I could get through on the phone line, so I'm thrilled. I just had a couple of things. First, I think that Arnie is completely correct when she said that, unfortunately, this is like a perfect storm for Toyota. Our politicians are looking for any excuse to get our minds off of jobs and health care and unemployment and our economy and Wall Street. I don't think that it would have been nearly as big a deal if the timing weren't the way that it is now. In terms of health care, I've been a type 1 diabetic for 26 years. I've worked in the health care industry for years. And universal health care, unfortunately, makes me very nervous because I am a chronic health condition. And I think emergent care, when you're walking in with an emergency, those situations will be better off with universal health care. But when I have to go in with chronic health condition issues that come up, especially as I get older and older, those are the things that are going to be harder for us to access unless we look at universal health care in a completely different light. And I guess my goal would be to see that those that are making policy would potentially be able to create something brand new. Rather than copying something that's already been done in another country, we are a nation of innovation, and we should be able to come up with something completely different that we haven't tried before.
Jean, thank you very much. That's a great call. We really appreciate it. And sorry it took so long for us to get to you. Thank you very much. Stefan, Arnie, building on what Jean said, I'm wondering if is the fundamental question that America needs to collectively answer is every American entitled to the same level of health care regardless of how sick they are, how young they are, how old they are, how healthy they are, how rich they are, or how poor they are? And if the answer is no, how do we synthesize that into telling somebody you don't get the MRI because you are blank, you know, fill in how sick they are or how rich they are, But you do because you fit that criteria. Is that what we need to answer?
Well, I think so, and I think that's what we do, and we will forever do that. And even in communist countries where supposedly everybody gets the same health care, the party leaders and, you know, the potentates and poobahs and commissars, they never, you know, got that level. They went abroad for health care, and when Fidel Castro gets sick, they fly in a Cuban surgeon for him, which the average Cuban isn't going to get. But what I think we need to do is to say that every American ought to have access to basic health care and have some preventive health care because it keeps the cost of other health care down. And that's the big challenge.
Arnie?
We're not offended when rich people get more than us. We're offended when we get nothing. Okay? It's not about everything, but don't give me nothing. I can't swallow that.
That's all the time we have for Talk of Iowa today. Stephen Schmidt, Arnie Arneson were our guests. Thank you to our callers as well. Our program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance today from Christina Sarnelli and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan All. Thanks for joining us.